Court for John Garcia and Xin Jing. Per the court's order, I'll address our motion for a limited remand. In its dismissal order, the district court laid out plaintiff's history of conduct in the case and his repeated refusals to obey the court's order, and sort of recounted the previous sanctions that it entered, and then concluded that dismissal of the case was appropriate. Now, because the FTCA claims were pending before the district court, its dismissal order is effective as to those claims. But because the Bivens claims were on interlocutory appeal before this court, the district court lacked jurisdiction over these claims. And accordingly, we filed a motion for a limited remand in this court to send those Bivens claims back. If the court does that, the district court, we believe, will dismiss those claims. And plaintiff McGee has already filed a notice of appeal from the dismissal order. So if the district court is able to exercise jurisdiction to dismiss the Bivens claims, that will be an appeal from final judgment. And then this court will have all issues presented in the case, the dismissal, qualified immunity, etc., available for its expedient resolution. We believe that this is the appropriate way to dispose of the case. Exactly.
But the only problem is that the court hasn't said that you wouldn't do that.
I think the best reading of the dismissal order, particularly given plaintiff's repeated refusals to follow court orders, is that this sort of conduct throughout the case means that dismissal of the entire case, including the Bivens claims, is warranted. The district court noted that those claims were on appeal, and then at the end of the order stated that it was dismissing the case in its entirety. I think the best and fairest reading of that is it intended to dismiss the Bivens claims. And if we're wrong about that, it remained in the district court says, actually, that's not what I meant, then this court retains jurisdiction, and I can consider all of the substance of the issue.
Isn't that procedurally what you're urging us to do? We said, order a limited remand, retain jurisdiction, let the district court attend to the housekeeping matters, then the case can come back to us if necessary to review the orders of the district court.
Exactly. Exactly, just to facilitate this court's resolution,
we still have the right to raise whatever merits arguments it has.
Precisely.
That's why the case should be allowed to us.
Precisely, and that's sort of the resolution that the First Circuit took in United States versus Cardozo about being in this court. It was a 28-J letter last week.
I was on the Rules Committee when we changed 12.1, and to me, this is sort of the poster child for why an indicative ruling would be appropriate in this case.
You mean an indicative?
Sorry, you're right. We could determine by inference, I guess, that the court indicated what it's likely to do, and we should let the court tell us clearly that's what it intends to do, and then we can address it.
I completely agree. If the court has any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Okay.
Thank you. Please, the court. My name is David Williams, counsel for Mr. Mendia. I'm joined in the courtroom today by Mr. Mendia and by my co-counsel, Ian Caruso. Your Honors, there is a problem with granting the motion for limited remand now because there is no need to break new procedural ground for this motion. The rules as they are written and the courts in this the cases in this circuit interpreting that rule set out a fairly clear and effective process for getting an indicative ruling and coming to this court for a limited remand. It includes a motion.
But why shouldn't we, in this case here, how are you going to be prejudiced if we do this? I mean, it will make it very clear to us what the district court wants to do with the case. You're still going to be preserving all of the legal arguments you have with regard to the underlying merits. This is why we amended the rule to just sort of to take care of these kinds of issues that sometimes arise when a piece of the case is pending on appeal and something else happens that the district court addresses below.
Well, there are at least two problems with granting the motion now, one of which is prejudice to Mr. Mendia.
And you want to know what, articulate what is the prejudice to Mr. Mendia?
Well,
given his conduct so far and the manner in which he's prosecuted this litigation.
Given the order, the May 31st order at issue here, it's not clear what the district court intended to do.
Counsel, you're not answering my question. It's a very simple question. How was Mr. McMahon going to be prejudiced by what we're talking about?
The concern is that sending this back to the district court now broadcasts the message that the Ninth Circuit, because the Ninth Circuit's imprimatur, we think sanctions should be imposed. We think this is a right prime position of sanctions when the district court didn't say that it was.
The district court has already imposed the most severe sanction that it can with regard to the rest of the cases.
You're afraid of losing the claims that are on appeal, right?
Yes. Yes, sir.
But your hope is that you can get them reversed, and then you're going to
Well, Mr. Mendia did prevail at the district court on the motion to dismiss. So the Bennett's claims, and we don't need to assume that the district court will simply dismiss the Bennett's claims, maybe because Mr. Mendia has been sanctioned heavily on the FTCA claims. They've been dismissed. He's been fined $3,500 and is being paid that fine. The conduct at issue occurred while only the FTCA claims were before the district court. The discovery has been somewhat bifurcated, and the discovery on the Bivens claims has been stayed against the appellants. And so this is essentially a case on two tracks.
It's on two tracks because the defendants have a right to bring an interlocutory appeal on a denial of qualified immunity. Right?
Right.
That's why we're in the procedural posture that we are. But they couldn't appeal the entire case because qualified immunity only addresses the Bivens claim.
Correct.
And they can't raise that as an offense to the FTCA.
And then the appellants in the district court have sought a stay on the discovery as to the Bivens claims. So this is a situation where this is discovery on FTCA claims. While only FTCA claims were before the district court, and the district court gave no clear indication that it intended to dismiss the Bivens claims as well. And last week,
the problem is that the factual record is going to be pretty similar with regard to both of your theories of liability.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I'm still wondering why it's going to be harder. If we send it back, ask the district court what it intends to do with regard to what's left of the case, and then you can come back to us with another notice of appeal where we're taking jurisdiction, and you can make all the arguments as to both of your theories of action.
Understood, Your Honor. And regardless of potential prejudice or not to the client, there's a precedential problem here, and that's that. Right now, the rules as they are, and the cases interpreting them, set up some prerequisites before the limited remands come.
Sure.
And these
ones are really going to be there to bring you guys what I'll call an inferential. If they get a ruling, and I think it might be helpful in the answer, and if we had a published opinion saying either we do or not, sure, just so you guys know.
And this case, this motion need not be decided on an issue. Are inferential indicative rulings proper or not? Because even under the First Circuit case that the appellant cited last week, the motion for limited remand would not satisfy that case because it essentially requires a clear statement. The language from the First Circuit,
what the purpose of the indicative ruling is to give the district court the opportunity to educate us as to what it's thinking, and which in this case could be significant depending on how she answers the question.
And the district court very well could have done that. And the counsel for the appellants are competent counsel. They at any time on May 31st, when the order was given, the week after, last month, last week, could have gone to the district court and asked for some clarity, but have not done so. So denying the motion for limited remand now helps reinforce a message to future litigants, future counsel, that says, before you come to the Ninth Circuit, whether or not this is done inferentially, whether it's done sua sponte, have some clarity in hand.
Well, which is the issues of the district court. The district court lost jurisdiction over the Bivens claim when the government filed its notice of appeal on the denial of qualified immunity. District courts understand that a notice of appeal divests them of jurisdiction to handle at least
the district court had that awareness and knew of this situation and had Rule 62.1 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure before it, it could have, if it intended to dismiss the Bivens claims, it very easily could have and should have stated, made some clear statement that it would dismiss the Bivens claims as well.
Well, this rule is relatively new. I don't think it's really much more than 8 or 10 years, and there's not a lot of case law interpreting it, so I'm not sure. I can fault the district court for not being a little more prescient.
Certainly, Your Honor, and I don't mean to fault the district court. The party who brought this motion, who looked at Rules 12.1 and 62.1, could have at any time before this oral argument gone to the district court and asked. And there's no need now to break new ground, allow for ambiguous orders to be the basis of limited remand, when the party who brought the motion simply could have got some clarity before coming here.
Okay.
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Sure. So procedurally, the reason we filed the motion in this court was because we had just received the district court's dismissal order, and if you remember exactly how long it was, a couple of days, we received a notice from this court that the case had been tentatively scheduled for oral argument in September. And so we were concerned that this needed to be before the court in order for it to understand the case, and we filed a motion in this court. And also, Rule 12.1 says once we receive an indicative ruling from the district court, which is how we read this, we need to notify the court of appeals, so we followed that procedure. And just to the point of prejudice, again, I don't understand exactly how the plaintiff would be prejudiced by remand. The district court can clearly state whether it intended to dismiss the defense claims or not, and then this court can consider whether or not that dismissal is the
correct decision. Are you saying that if this case had not been sent for oral argument practically simultaneously with the court's dismissal, that the appeal was still either waiting or the plaintiff's case that you might ask for?
I'm not sure that it would have made a difference, but I guess it just sort of amplified our need to file a motion with this court, if that makes sense.
Well, it seems to me that normally you should ask for an indicative ruling if there's been a kind of bifurcation.
Sure, but just based on our reading of it, saying the district court's order at the end saying that we're dismissing the action in its entirety and closing its docket. Yes, that's how we read it.
What happens if we did not remand and we decide the merits of the Bivens claim? What's the practical effect on the rest of what we paid in the district court?
If you were not to remand and decide the merits of the Bivens claims, we would obviously ask the court to reverse on that, and then the district court would receive the case and enter an order dismissing those claims. That would be a final judgment at that point.
So the case would be?
That would occur as well, yes. If we were to win, which we're asking the court. If we were to lose, and we would urge the court not to reach that result, then those claims would be remanded to the district court, at which point the district court could dismiss them because it intended to dismiss them as a sanction for plaintiff's conduct as well.
Imagine whether the court is not going to have to decide the merits of the claim unless it seems like it would have to because if there was appeal for the dismissal by support of sanction, then the merits would be
Well, if I could suggest one logistical treatment of the appeals, if this court remands, district court dismisses as a sanction, there is an appeal from that saying it's dismissal was an abuse of discretion. At that point, this court could consolidate those appeals or hold the qualified immunity appeals in advance while it decides the dismissal as a sanction appeal. And if it affirms that dismissal and says that it's an appropriate use of your discretion given the facts in this case, then it would not need to decide the qualified immunity issues presented.
Thank you.